This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is an edited recording of this year's BFM Extreme Health event by Sunway Medical Center.
Our session 4 topic is bad sleep, bad diet, bad heart question. That's why we got 4 speakers. To help us with this very difficult topic, can I please invite on stage Dr. Usha Rani George, Consultant General and Chest Physician, Sunway Medical Center. We also have Dr. Shailendra Sivalingam, Consultant ENT, Head and Neck Surgeon, Sunway Medical Center. Dr. Muhammad Kamal Muhammad Arshad, Consultant Interventional Cardiologist, Sunway Medical Center. And also Lau Wai Hong, Celeste, a Manager of Dietetics and Nutrition Services Center, Sunway Medical Center. Okay, our moderator, there she is again, Levi Chui Lin, presenter from the evening edition. Bad sleep, bad diet, bad heart?
Okay, we're going to try to answer that question. Thank you all for staying for the last panel of the day. And just to set things off for everybody, I thought we could start by trying to link everything up. Perhaps you could tell us, what are the links between diet, sleep, and heart health? Anybody?
So I think all three are interrelated. First of all, diet. If you look at diet, if you don't control your diet in terms of high-calorie diet, you can get obesity. Obesity is a risk factor for heart disease. As well, if you're linking in with cholesterol. So if you take fatty, although 80% of our body produces the cholesterol is produced by our own body, but dietary cholesterol, dietary fat is also important. So if you increase your lipids, your cholesterol, so that's related to the heart in terms of a risk factor for heart disease as well. In terms of sleep, you know, there is a study showing that sleep is related to poor sleep is related to increase in poor cardiovascular health as well. Partly because of the effects of sleep, where you actually, that's the time when you need to rest and the heart is resting at the time.
On average, I suppose, would you say that Malaysians are doing well in terms of our sleep and our diet?
Certainly the incidence of obesity has increased in Malaysia. I think conventionally our diet is predominantly carbohydrate, lack of exercise. And the topic today really is disordered breathing during sleep associated with obesity, namely increasing incidence of sleep apnea. They're all interlinked, and probably as the panel goes on, we will delve more into the different issues.
Now, you bring up that point about how it's about disordered breathing during sleep, and I think that is perhaps the most common thing people think about before they think about sleep apnea is actually snoring. It's more audible. People tend to have a lot of sleep disturbance over it. Is snoring linked to sleep apnea? What is going on from an anatomical point of view when we're talking about this?
Well, first of all, when you talk about snoring, not everyone who snores will have sleep apnea, but almost everyone who has sleep apnea will snore. There's a distinction there because there's other factors apart from just the snoring itself, which contribute to the development of sleep apnea. Now, the entire thing about the structural pathway of breathing is the key to understanding a little bit about why snoring as well as sleep apnea occurs. Now, the airway itself, if you look at a non-obstructed airway, basically, naturally, you breathe via your nose. The air circulates through the nose, down the back of the nose, and down behind your tongue, down to your larynx. But if you have an obstructed airway, what happens is that your body automatically opens your mouth. You breathe via your mouth. Now, when you breathe via your mouth, that's a rather inefficient pathway of breathing. And that delivers less air and is also more prone for obstruction. And what that does then is that as the airway in the mouth, in the throat, is obstructed, that narrowed airway actually causes snoring. Snoring is essentially just the noise you hear when the tissues in the throat vibrate. And why do they vibrate? Actually, it's a physics principle. I don't know if you remember your physics. There's a Bernoulli's principle, where a column of fast-moving air or water generates an area of low pressure around it. So when you breathe in via your mouth, this column of air generates an area of low pressure around it, and that sucks in the lax tissues in the throat. And that actually causes the snoring. And as that condition progresses throughout the night of sleep, it gets to a point where the airway actually closes. And when that airway closes up, your breathing stops. That period when your breathing stops, it's what is medically known as apnea. So it's an obstructive sleep apnea. That means it's caused by an obstruction during sleep. And that period of apnea can last from maybe 1 or 2 seconds up to, in some patients, it lasts for about maybe 10 to 15 seconds. And then the body wakes you up. So that cycle of sleeping, obstruction, and waking up again actually leads to the poor quality of sleep that you see. So it's related to the structure of the airway in a great, great deal.
Having said that, I mean, it's a particularly common condition among overweight people, older people. What is it anatomically that's causing that? How does weight, I suppose, in particular, affect that?
Well, basically, it's because when you sleep, most of the time you're sleeping in what is called, you sleep on your back. It's called a supine position. And when that happens, when you sleep, naturally, the tone of the muscles in your throat, as well as your neck, tend to reduce. So this muscle tone, when it reduces, narrows your airway in the throat, and your tongue tends to fall back. Now, in obese individuals, they have a lot of subcutaneous fat around the neck and the upper chest, and that actually adds weight onto the upper airway, and that's why you see sleep apnea more commonly in obese individuals.
With that said, I've also heard, at least anecdotally, of people who are superficially perfectly healthy, they're not overweight, they're not older, and yet they have sleep apnea. So is this, is it something that you need to be especially concerned of if you don't fall into the regular sort of idea of who should have sleep apnea and you do?
Now, usually if the patient is not an obese individual, there's usually an obstruction within the airway itself. Now, some of these obstructions can be because of what's called large tonsils and enlarged adenoids. The adenoids are actually similar to the tonsils. Most of us have heard of the tonsils. We get tonsillitis and infected tonsils in the throat. Now, that can obstruct your throat, but the adenoids are actually similar to the tonsils, but they are located behind the nose. So in some individuals who don't fit the classic profile of a sufferer of obstructive sleep apnea, you find them to have enlarged tonsils, enlarged adenoids. And another area where they can have problems is in the nose. They can have what's called a deviated nasal septum, where the bone that divides the nose in the middle to left and right is actually deviated. And that actually causes narrowing of the airway through the nose. And that actually forces them to breathe via the mouth. And if they so happen to have enlarged tonsils, then the entire process is worsened even further.
Now, before we get further into sleep apnea, even though that is our theme, there are a lot of questions that are coming in from the floor about snoring, I suppose, because, like I said, that tends to be the more, I guess, commonly heard, commonly thought of condition. And so someone wants to know, is snoring actually a bad sign in terms of your health? And what can be done to reduce snoring?
As Dr. Shailendra pointed out, snoring does not equate sleep apnea. But generally, if you have sleep apnea, you should snore. Now, this question is snoring detrimental? To a certain degree, yes, even if it's not related with sleep apnea, because we find that the constant vibration results in something called upper airway resistance. Even the mere fact of snoring will disrupt your proper sleep. Actually, to put it very simply, what is sleep? Now, sleep is, there are different, we say, stages of sleep. There's something called, basically, into two main stages, REM sleep and non-REM sleep. We start off going into stage one, which is light sleep. That will last for maybe 5% of the sleep cycle. Then we go into stage two, which is predominantly, occupies about 45%, before we go into slow wave sleep. Now, you really need slow-wave sleep to feel refreshed after a night. After 90 minutes of proper sleep, there's what we call a REM sleep. That is rapid eye movement, and that is where we dream. But generally, we are atonic. Otherwise, we'll be doing kung fu fighting while we sleep. Now, all these stages of sleep are important to feel refreshed the next day. So it has been shown that when you snore, it affects REM sleep and it affects slow wave sleep. Based on that, if you don't get refreshed sleep, then obviously snoring can be detrimental.
We're going to get further into the dietary habits of Malaysians as a whole a little further down. But when it comes to sleep, I just wanted to dip into this one thing. There's a lot of conversation about when we should have dinner. People often say, you know, you shouldn't have it too late. You shouldn't have coffee too close to sleep. You shouldn't do certain things or it'll affect your sleep. Would you like to weigh in on that in terms of how our diet can impact our sleep?
I think most of the things that we say affecting sleeping is the caffeine. So caffeine is one of the things that definitely is actually act as a stimulant that it actually makes you more alert rather than to sleep better. And caffeine normally works for 3 to 5 hours. I mean, it does take time to digest. So that's why if you drink coffee, especially in the evening, then it might affect your sleeping or to go into deep sleep. So that might be the one. If for those who always have sleeping problems, actually we advise them not to take coffee in the afternoon. But for different people, they have different load of caffeine because some of them, they say, I drink 4 cups of coffee, I can sleep very good. Or 1 cup, then I have palpitation. So everyone, the loads for the caffeine is actually quite different. It's okay. But if you really have the problem for sleeping problems, then I'd be advised to cut or to reduce it from your loads.
And in terms of eating healthily, does it matter how close we eat before we go to sleep?
It takes 2 hours or so for glucose to digest, but it takes 8 hours for protein or even fats to digest, take even longer time. But if you say to sleep better, I'll say more than at least that 2 or 3 hours, because at least that it will not be like congested or the things too full. And we also advise if you're not active at night, so try to take something light rather than heavy as for your lunch. We always tell patients to compare. Are you eating the same load for your lunch and dinner? Are you doing the same things for your lunch and dinner time? So if you are doing less active, then try to eat lesser at night especially.
We'll be back with more from the panel discussion at the recent BFM Extreme Health event by Sunway Medical Centre. This is an edited recording of this year's BFM Extreme Health event by Sunway Medical Centre.
Dr. Kamal, I mean, it stands to reason that if we're talking about sleep apnea in particular, it seems that if you stop breathing and you stop breathing long enough to wake up, there is an effect on the heart, or it would seem so. I'm curious whether it's a sort of chicken and egg situation. You know, among people with cardiovascular conditions, how common is sleep apnea, or is sleep apnea a symptom of cardiovascular conditions?
Yeah, sure. I think it's difficult to know. One thing for sure, obstructive sleep apnea is a definite cardiovascular risk factor. Okay, so if you have sleep apnea, you have a higher chance of getting a cardiovascular event. Cardiovascular event meaning heart attacks, strokes, and the like. I mean, if you have cardiovascular disease, do you get sleep apnea? It's probably less of a relation, but there are studies looking at that, and they looked at patients who have sleep apnea, who's not known to have cardiovascular disease, and they followed them up for a few years, and then when they look, and they tested them for sleep apnea, and 57% of them had sleep apnea. So, and there's a few more studies like that looking at heart failure, which is an end result of cardiovascular disease or end result of any heart disease. And this kind of patients, even heart failure patients, when they look at study them for sleep apnea, you can see maybe about 40 to 50% have sleep apnea. So, you know, it's not a direct causal relationship. Of course, cardiovascular disease is a lot of other risk factors, smoking, diabetes, and everything else. But, you know, it seems to be a strong link between the two. Whether it's a causal link, as in this causes that, we're not sure. But the association is definitely there.
And there was a question from Pigeonhole about whether there is a link between sleep apnea or sleep deprivation and high blood pressure. Is there?
That's definitely there. If you look at sleep is the time when you have it's called a physiological resting state for you. Okay, so when you're sleeping, your parasympathetic activity is higher, your sympathetic activity is lower. Sympathetic causes heart rate to increase and also blood pressure to increase. So when you're sleeping, your heart rate goes down, your blood pressure goes down, and even sometimes when you look, if somebody's sleeping, check the blood pressure, it's very low. Sometimes systolic is about less than 100. Heart rate can be about 40-something. Okay? But that's normal because you're sleeping. So that's a good time for the heart to rest. So in theory, if you don't get enough rest and sleep, but if you have sleep apnea where you're actually waking up many times, hundreds of times a night, there will be an effect on your cardiovascular disease. And there is an effect in terms of studies have shown that those with sleep apnea definitely have a higher rate of events. Events meaning stroke and heart attacks.
We've been talking about disrupted sleep, but a lot of people just don't feel like they're getting enough sleep in general. You know, even if you are sleeping the whole night, you don't feel that it's enough. Do we have a magic number? For example, there's a question from Pigeonhole about whether there is a difference between sleeping for 7 hours straight versus, say, 5 hours, and then you top it up with 2 hour naps later on. Is there a difference for our body in terms of that uninterrupted sleep?
I think it's all to do with quality of sleep. The question is, are you not developing slow wave sleep at all, or you don't have REM sleep? Some of our patients says, you know, doctor, I can't go to sleep, so, you know, I have 2-3 packs of whiskey. I go to sleep easily after a drink, but I get up feeling still a bit groggy. And the reason is, for instance, alcohol. Yes, we all feel that we sleep well after a few drinks, but the problem is alcohol decreases REM sleep. REM is needed for the brain to regenerate, for good cognitive function. So really, it's not the duration of sleep, but it is the quality of sleep. That is why later on, if we do talk about sleep study in the labs, we are actually able to quantify at which stage of sleep the patient is having.
We also hear a lot about sleep debt. You hear people say that all the time. I need to pay it back. I need to pay it back. Does that matter?
I mean, recently, I think anecdotally, we have a lot of young executive types and say, I'm fit. I do one conference call after another. I really don't need sleep. Sleep is boring. It's old-fashioned. And you've had recently a few sudden deaths of these so-called Indian-type CEOs in the States. And they're fit. They lead healthy lifestyles. They don't smoke. But what's the common denominator when you look back? They all have less than 5 hours sleep. And it's been shown that sleep deprivation increases inflammatory markers. If you look at CRP, tumor necrosis factor, this all predisposes to sudden cardiac death. So it's real.
To come back to sleep apnea, so we've been talking about how it comes about, why it comes about, but surely there are degrees of severity as well. You know, I'm assuming it's not all one and the same. How do we kind of detect and diagnose and measure how severe sleep apnea is?
Well, you can do what's called a polysomnogram. That's a sleep study. It can be done either in the hospital. Usually that's the gold standard of sleep studies, which is done in the hospital, is an observed sleep study where the patient actually spends the night in the hospital in a special room where he can be observed throughout his time of sleep. And we measure certain criteria, like, for example, we measure his heart rate, his blood pressure, his oxygen saturation in the blood, his chest movement, his movement overall, his snoring, the duration of the snoring, as well as how loud he snores, and how many periods of apnea he has, the duration of each period of apnea, and multiple other criteria can be measured. Now, that's the gold standard, which is extremely accurate, and that's done in the hospital. The second possibility is what is called a portable polysomnogram, which is also known as a home sleep study. And that's a more portable device. It doesn't measure all the criteria that are measured in the sleep lab in the hospital, but it has an up to about 90% validated accuracy compared to the polysomnogram in the hospital. Now, that is something where when the patient does this home sleep study, they come and attach the device onto you at your own home and you sleep with it. The next day, they take it back and then they generate the report from there. Now, based on these studies, we can actually quantify the sleep apnea severity into mild, moderate, and severe. There are certain measurements. We measure periods of apnea where the breathing stops completely, and you also measure periods of what's called hypopnea, where the breathing slows down. Now, these events are added together and divided over the total hours of sleep, and then you get a certain score. Now, based on that score, you can quantify them into mild, moderate, or severe.
And how do the treatment options change depending on that?
I think the treatment options depend on not only the scoring of the sleep study, but also other factors like whether the patient is obese or whether there are structural issues. In my patients, for example, if they are obese, I tell them that, you know, whatever treatment you decide to do, you've got to lose weight. And you've got to lose a significant amount of weight, you know. You can't just lose 1 kilo and think that you're doing something useful. No, you've got to lose a significant amount of weight. And that's just one aspect of it. The other aspect is if it's a structural issue, you've got to address the structural issue. And then there are non-surgical methods of treatment also. So the scoring as such is only part of it. If you get a bad score on your sleep study, well, that really indicates that treatment is almost mandatory rather than what treatment is required. What treatment is required depends on the individual.
And since losing weight would be of such importance, Celeste, maybe you could jump in here about the obesity rates in Malaysia. Of course, we've all heard the news. You know, it's on the rise. It's becoming a huge problem. As a dietitian, what are you interested in getting people to understand about eating healthier and eating healthier to lose weight?
Based on the Malaysian studies, people start gaining weight at the age of 35 onwards. So the peak is actually around 50, 55 until 60. Then it comes down later. So if we are in that category, that means that our weight is gained easier compared to the other groups of people. One of the things is because our activity level also changed. It's not as active as last time. But if we still eat the same as what we have previously done, then, of course, weight gain easier compared to other groups. Then the second is, of course, is our lifestyle and our food choices. Nowadays, people are also eating out most of the time rather than eating at home. And when eating out, you'll crave for something that is good, delicious, or very strong taste. The things taste very strong or good normally is fats, I would say, or sugar. But if you can control that sort of food, actually it helps you also to control your weight even though you say eating out. So actually we have choice if we eat out, but we still can eat healthy. That's always a way. We also encourage people to eat small and frequent rather than eat all at one time. Because nowadays people, they try to skip meal to lose weight, but that is not a good idea. So when you try to skip more meal, actually it triggers you to get hunger more, so that and you will tend to overeat. And the food that you eat, it might be something tend to be very sweetened or very fattening. So there are studies, some things that you're prone to have those food, and those are the things that it can store longer in your body. And that's why smaller, frequent way, it will actually works better to control weight rather than skipping meal. And weight is not easy to lose, but it's hard to maintain. It's very easy for you to lose 1 or 2 kg, even if you say for 1 or 2 months. But the thing is that after you lost weight, then it's like very fast that you say, hey, I'm success. So I eat back again. So when you eat back, whatever things that you do again, then you can regain very fast. So it comes into behavior change rather than just only eating.
And we can't talk about obesity without talking about its impact on heart health. And Dr. Kumar, one of the things that I've noticed about heart disease is when we discuss it, we often talk about it in terms of heart attacks, heart failure, cardiac arrest, all these traumatic events. You know, we always talk about it in these sort of big terms, medical emergencies. But what are the early signs that your heart health may not be what you want it to be?
So yeah, when we talk about heart failure and also heart attacks, they are at the end of the spectrum of the disease process. You know, basically that's the end event of the process. So if you're talking about heart attacks, cardiovascular disease, I mean normally it's basically the coronary arteries are narrowed. So initially when they start to get narrowed, then you start to get symptoms at some point. So initially you will not have symptoms, but if your arteries are narrow enough, if the block is not 100%, maybe if it's starting to go about 60% or 50% and above, then you probably start getting symptoms. So your symptoms could be, number one, you can get chest pain. So chest pain on exertion normally. So the classical textbook angina, what you call, is that when you have chest pain when you're doing something, for example, if you're walking on the flat, you're okay, but as soon as you walk uphill, then you start to get chest pain. Or if you're going upstairs, you go up 2 flights of stairs, you get chest pain. Chest pain means different things to different people, but when we say chest pain, we mean anything, any discomfort in the chest. If you're feeling aching pain in the chest, not pain necessarily, just aching or heaviness in the chest, when you're on exertion, and when you stop, when you rest, it goes away. So that's one of the early signs of cardiovascular disease. When you say early, that means that that person already has cardiovascular disease at that point if you have those symptoms. But I think earlier than that, it's difficult. There won't be any symptoms. But up to that point, that's one of the earliest ones. As opposed to heart attack, which is the more severe chest pain, that one you definitely know about it. That's for coronary artery disease. But in terms of heart failure, you can also have some, sometimes your heart started to get weak. So what you can get is also shortness of breath on exertion. So shortness of breath where you sit down and then it goes away. Or you can get some ankle swelling, or you can also get sometimes when you're trying to lie down at night to sleep, you can't lie down flat. You need to lie down propped up. You need like 3 pillows to sleep. Okay, if you lie down flatter, you get short of breath. So that's another sign. And also sometimes people wake up from sleep breathless. You know, they're sleeping and suddenly woke up very, very breathless. So that could just mean you have a bad nightmare, but you know, it can also mean that you have a sign or a symptom of heart failure. Other than that, you can get also rhythm problems, so you can get palpitations, so you can get the sense of your heartbeat going very fast. So that also could mean you know, something related to your heart. So for all these symptoms, you have to, you know, get yourself checked out and just see a doctor and take it from there.
Do we have any questions from the floor? I see we have one over there.
Just like I heard the panelists say, if we have REM sleep, we have good quality of sleep. I have 8 hours of sleep every night. Most of the time, I dream, and I wake up very tired. Do you have quality sleep, and is there any advice for me to improve? And secondly, is some people experience sleep paralysis, which is transition between wakefulness and sleep, and suddenly they wake up and they couldn't move. Is there any treatment for that? Thank you.
Now, this really is basically sleep disorders. Now, that's a huge topic. Now, the first question is, you say you sleep 8 hours, but you feel not rested when you get up. I mean, looking at you from here, you don't look obese, but do you snore? All right, you don't snore. So the thing is, there could be many reasons why you lack REM sleep. For instance, taking caffeine, you don't have proper sleep hygiene, like you may be type 1 or you may be a shift worker. The sleep may be not conducive or you may be stressed. So I think sleep medicine really is extremely complex. So in a case like yours, where it's not an obvious sleep apnea, then we come into the realm of sleep medicine, from insomnia to getting up early or dream state, etc. So this really requires very detailed consultation with a sleep physician as to history about whether you're on medication, what your lifestyle is, stress issues. It really needs a proper assessment. Now, sleep paralysis, again, that's a sleep disorder reading. Now, when you have REM sleep, you are supposed to be atonic, all right? Now, there's a condition called narcolepsy, which is associated with sleep paralysis, which is you tend to fall asleep all over the place. And basically, you've got very short sleep latency. Usually, it takes 15 to 20 minutes to get into N2 stage sleep. But if that happens quickly and you keep falling asleep all the time, associated with sleep paralysis, that's a condition called as narcolepsy. So that, again, requires further assessment in the hospital. All right. And that really is related to neurotransmitter problems. There is treatment. As I was just talking to Lynn before the show about this prep up or pop me up pills, like Ritalin or Modafinil. So these things, narcolepsy or sleep paralysis, you treat them with this. Unfortunately, like everything in life, medicines are abused, and a lot of students who, you know, want to stay awake, they want to work through the night, you know, use these prep-me-up pills for different reasons. So, but I think if you have those problems, you probably will need to see a neurologist who specializes in sleep medicine.
Because Dr. Usha did mention about sleep hygiene, I think that is important. Nowadays, we look at the screen, some bright screen, before we sleep, that also will disturb our sleep pattern. And also, if your room is something with lights, it also will affect your sleep pattern and to go into deep sleep. Because sometimes we thought we are sleeping, but actually we are not really run into that level of sleep yet. So that's why you can also see people, why they are quite alert every time. They can hear every sound, any sound when it happened. That means they haven't really go into that deep sleep yet. Sometimes we assume, but if you really have consistent problems with the sleep or even more tired after you sleep, I think, yeah, have to get a proper consultation, even to talk to a clinical psychologist. They can also do some assessment on that.
And we have a question right down here.
Nowadays, we got gadgets, wearable gadgets that we can put on to sleep, and it calculates, I'm guessing it's from movement and heart rate as well. And it actually gives you your deep sleep. Could you comment a little bit about these gadgets and how, I may not say it's 100% accurate, but is it a good gauge? Second question, sorry if you don't mind. Sleeping with pillow and without pillow, there's some things that have been going on. Without pillow or very thin pillow is actually better than having, especially if you're lying supine, if you can comment about that.
I'll answer the pillow question. Because I want to answer the other one about the devices, because I'll give you a rough answer, okay? It's not good enough to make a clinical diagnosis. It's just for you to get a gauge on whether you have a problem or not. That's all it is, you know? Now, the pillow thing, essentially, it boils down to anatomy again. You know, when you're lying down supine and you're straight, your airway is open, you know? But if you're lying on a pillow, your head is elevated slightly, and that's going to create a small kink, you know? And anywhere that there's a kink is an area of narrowing. So anywhere that there's an area of narrowing is going to be progressive collapse of your airway in that area. So a pillow, yes. I mean, most of us can't sleep with without a pillow, but it can't be a pillow that's too high or too thick. You know, so that's why you have all of these special pillow designs where they support the neck, allow your head to be level. So that's probably the reason why. So yes, you can sleep with a pillow. It doesn't have to be a super thin pillow, but it shouldn't be a very, very thick pillow either.
Dr. Shailendra, if I can just jump in on that, because there was another question from Pigeonhole about posture. So is there correct? The word they used here was correct, but I'm wondering if there's better, maybe if there's better posture that we should be adopting that won't cause neck or joint pains, or rather would just contribute towards better sleep as a whole.
Definitely, if you're talking about correct posture, when you hunch or your head is down all the time, your airway is also going to be narrowed. It's going to be harder for you to take a breath as opposed to when your head is up and you're breathing more freely. And to give you a very technically accurate, clinically accurate answer about posture, I can't, because that's not my area of speciality. But I can tell you that definitely if you hunch, your head is always down, it's going to be more difficult for you to breathe.
And when it comes to sleep, is there any sort of ideal, whether it's on your back, on your side?
Well, actually, most people sleep supine. That's been proven. And even when we do the sleep studies, they actually measure the duration of time that you spend sleeping either supine or on your right or on your left. Now, usually, when you lie supine, naturally because of the decreased tone of your tongue as well as your throat muscles, your tongue falls back. And when you lie on your side, your tongue tends to move forward slightly. So lying on the side tends to improve your breathing slightly. And the other reason is because if you're an obese individual and you're lying on your back, your abdominal fat actually goes up. And that actually prevents your diaphragm from actually expanding properly. Now, when you take a breath, your diaphragm contracts and moves down. If you've got a lot of abdominal fat and abdominal contents preventing that from happening, you can't take a good breath. So when you lie on your side, that allows that abdominal contents to shift away.
We were talking about treatment for sleep apnea earlier, and we went into weight loss because that's very important. But something that I think a lot of people will be familiar with is the CPAP machine, or the continuous positive airway pressure. It's a contraption. Could you talk us through it? How does that work? How does it actually help to improve the lives of people with sleep apnea?
Again, very quickly, sleep apnea, when you sleep, the pharyngeal muscles relax. And as we get older, naturally, you know, the tone is down, it collapses. So basically, the CPAP provides positive pressure to open up the upper airway. Now, how do you deliver this positive pressure? So it has to be just with a contraption that produces exactly what it means, positive pressure. There is this machine, which is very portable now. The main important thing is the interface between the machine and the patient. The advance over the last 10 years, those days we used to wear a vacuum machine over the face, but now the advance is in the interface. So either you get nasal pillows, so you got three types mainly, the face mask over the nose, the nasal pillows just tubes through your nostrils so that you don't get claustrophobia, but if you sleep with your mouth open the whole night, you need a full face mask, that is a mask over your nose and face. I gather that the rest of my panel here will be too young to remember like I do. When I was young, the cars were without air conditioning. So the windows will be down, and when our fathers were driving, what do? We stick our head out of a moving car, and we got the thrill of it. But it's not so thrilling if that happens the whole night. So that is exactly how you feel. If you put your head out of a moving car and that pressure, and that will be how you feel when a CPAP is applied over your face. So that takes something getting used to. Lynn was saying that there is problems with compliance. My answer to that, the solution is choosing the right patient. If your patient truly has sleep apnea, has such poor quality of sleep, remember, what is the biggest punishment you can administer to anybody? Deprive them of sleep. And that's how torture chambers used to work before. So if you find that you have an obese patient who is deprived of sleep, and after applying the CPAP, basically just pressure support, pull it out, and he gets the most amazing sleep the next day, he will do whatever it takes to get used to the machine. But if you apply a CPAP machine to someone where you've made the wrong diagnosis, the patient may not have sleep apnea, maybe a problem with insomnia, then it's going to be a lost battle.
We'll be back with more from the panel discussion at the recent BFM Extreme Health event by Sunway Medical Center. This is an edited recording of this year's BFM Extreme Health event by Sunway Medical Center.
And what are your thoughts about alternative remedies such as acupuncture when it comes to sleep apnea?
Well, short answer is I don't have any concrete opinion on that because it's not really evidence-based. It's very anecdotal. Some people say it works for them, some people say it doesn't. So I can't really comment on that.
While we've been talking about people who are overweight or who may not have great diets or great habits, that doesn't mean that superficially healthy people are exempt and that they're getting great sleep, you know, or eating really, really well. What are some potential pitfalls that people who regularly exercise might fall into? I think there was reference earlier about the possibility of, you know, overeating, things like that. What do you see from your patients who are seemingly very healthy, but still might have certain bad habits?
You know, some people exercise a lot. They do all the right things. Because of that, sometimes they fall into the trap thinking that, you know, the exercise will compensate for anything else, any other bad habits that they do. I have a personal friend who says I run to eat, so that's justifying his eating, but I'm running, so it's okay. So it's not okay because unfortunately, one day while he was running, then he passed away while running. So that's it happens. So, and we've seen that with a lot of events, running events and things like that, where people just died during this kind of events. So, your exercise cannot compensate for other risk factors. So if you have, you know, things like cardiovascular disease, the risk factors are clear. You have like smoking, you have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, family history, your age, are all interplay together. So if you have one thing good about the whole thing, where you are exercising, it helps, but it doesn't compensate. You still have to look at the other risk factors.
And we have a question from the audience.
Hi. I have a question for polyphasic sleeping. There are many accounts of people claiming to sleep less than 2 hours in total. So how they do it is they break their sleep to 4 sessions between the morning and the night. And what they do is between maybe probably 15 minutes of nap and then the whole 6 hours of active working, And after that, they fall back to sleep again for a period of 4 to 7 times. So any comments on that? Because I believe there are many studies around showing that with non-REM and REM sleep, there's a way to hack sleeping by this kind of methods.
To be honest, I'm not a sleep physician. I'm a respiratory physician relating with sleep audit. So I must say I've not personally come across polyphasic sleeping. But the thing is, the brain can be trained. I mean, we all have been on flights. Have you ever wondered how the stewards and air stewards, they manage? Their circadian rhythm is all over the place. So I think the way the brain adjusts with the melatonin levels, so I think similarly with polyphasic sleep, it's all a matter of conditioning and what stimulates the brain. But at the end of the day, you will still need REM sleep, slow wave sleep. Whether that happens over the night or whether it happens at different times, the brain can condition itself. It's not scientific, but I must say I'm not really sure unless you can obviously do sleep staging and see what happens really.
I'm not an expert on polyphasic sleeping either, but some people do it and they claim that they are very successful, they get good results with it. But what I can say is that you may be able to do it for a little while, but you won't be able to do it all the time. Eventually, it's going to catch up with you because we are made in such a way that we need a certain amount of rest. And when you're young, you're physically fit, you would think that you can do anything. But eventually, it all catches up with you. So whatever is being done, whatever you're doing to yourself, you must remember that your body is a living organism which breaks down, which needs to be repaired. And the time of repair is sleep. So if you're doing this, breaking your sleep, you're actually disturbing that cycle of repair. And eventually, it will catch up with you.
When it comes to sleep, I think we often, or at least among my circle of friends, I know that I've gotten more than my fair share of tips on how to sleep better. You know, people are very quick to tell you, oh, do this, do that, don't eat this, don't eat that, take melatonin or don't. At what point would you say somebody should go see a medical specialist or a medical professional if they feel that their sleep has been lacking?
If you're talking about sleep apnea, actually there's a simple way to know whether you should go and see a medical specialist or not. And that's by taking a simple questionnaire. It's easily available, you can download it. It's called the Epworth Sleepiness Score, okay? Epworth, E-P-W-O-R-T-H. It's just a simple questionnaire, and based on the answers that you give yourself a scoring. You must give yourself an honest scoring. Now, based on that, if you fall within the certain categories of scoring, then you know that there is a high likelihood, and therefore you need to go and get yourself examined and get a proper consultation.
And just to close off, what would your final message be on good sleep, good diet, and good heart? What would that look like?
Actually, sleep really is becoming more and more invasive because, you know, when I see my inpatients and I do my morning round, even if they have a blooming pneumonia or an asthma attack, the main thing they will tell me, oh, doctor, I couldn't sleep. I had a bad sleep. Or the nurses kept interrupting, I couldn't sleep. So obviously, achieving the eternal nirvana of good sleep is a problem. And to be honest, there's no one simple answer. But I guess common sense would dictate just healthy lifestyle. Eat in moderation, exercise more, good sleep hygiene, stay away from additives, stimulants. But a lot of times, you know, stresses in life, it's easier said than done. I'm afraid really that I think presently the medical fraternity doesn't have all the answers.
And I'm hoping that good diet can be a little more clearly laid out for us.
We have to eat every day. So it's like sleep, we have to sleep every day. A lot of studies looking at, hey, if you really sleep lesser, how will it affect your weight? How does it affect your eating? These are all still ongoing. Why people still try to look for all these answers? Because it's like they don't know what caused the problem. But besides eating, we cannot really forget about our habits of eating. It's not only what you eat, it's how you eat and when you eat. What do you do after you eat? So that is also important rather than just only what we eat. And second, if we eat something affecting our sleep, like the caffeine, even our chocolates, even our coca, all these things also contain caffeine, not only as in like coffee just now. So there are a lot of things that affect our digestive system as well. People become very bloated when they sleep. So try to identify what those food that affect your digestive system, that affect your sleeping pattern. And last but not least, I think maintain healthy eating. Try to have some things that with high antioxidants, and it's also good for hearts, of course.
Yes, in terms of heart health, again, look after your risk factors. In general, to the Malaysian population, we sometimes don't know our risk factors, and we don't test our risk factors. So it's quite, our national health and mobility survey, then the country's health survey show that most people don't even know that they have high cholesterol, don't even know that they have high sugar or diabetes, and also high blood pressure. So it's just a simple trip to the doctor and just checking your blood cholesterol, blood glucose, and also look after your sleep and your food and get some exercise. I think that's essentially it. Easier said than done, but screening is important. So older than 30 years, you should get screened every year. Cholesterol, glucose, your high blood pressure checked every year at least.
Okay. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you all very much for listening.
This event was brought to you by Sunway Medical Center.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.